Hello and welcome to No Directions 2017 Gen Con Seminar Coverage. Special thanks to our Gen Con volunteers, Eric Bring the Knives and Andrew Mullins. For more seminars and other great Pathfinder content, visit NoDirectionPodcast.com.
You're recording?
Yes.
Okay, and that is way earned and dice.
That was a good story, Owen.
Thank you. Thank you.
Very informative. So many secrets revealed.
At cons, never anywhere else. And I'm personally convinced if anyone ever bought all of the Pathfinder products, they'd find the clues and be able to put it together.
Oh, definitely.
All right, let's get
good
started.
Good luck, guys.
Thank you. Thanks.
All right. Welcome, everybody, to the Starfinder Rules Q&A. Thanks to those of you who have been here for the last few. Let's go ahead and go down the line and introduce ourselves.
Hi, I'm Owen Casey Stevens, and I am the Starfinder Design Lead.
I'm Jason Keeley. I'm a developer who's been primarily working on Starfinder for the past while.
I'm James L. Sutter. I'm the Creative Director on Starfinder, and my job at this panel is going to be to look stern and nod as I let Owen take the fall for all of the decisions that I forced upon him.
Not all of them. If it's a Starship decision, I will look sternly at Caleb.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, no.
So this is being a Starfinder rules Q&A. This really is just a chance for you guys to ask us all your questions about the rules, whether that's how stuff works, whether that's questions on the philosophy, questions on how we decided to do what we did. This panel is really for you guys, so we'll be answering whatever you want to know, pretty much.
Or dodging.
Like, this is not going to be an errata panel, you know, but...
I do want to say, though, there is a frequently asked questions post up on paizo.com, so... Subscribers and playtesters and some other people had advanced copies, so we already had some frequently asked questions, and we decided to try and address them as fast as possible. Obviously, the game was otherwise released yesterday officially, so some stuff will take a while to look at and come up with conclusions for.
Yeah.
But so, also, how come I can't go buy the book is not a rules Q&A.
And we should mention about that. We really thank you guys so much because we were really shocked. Like, we brought more of the Starfinder Core rulebook than we've brought of any product ever before by a lot.
By a big percentage.
Yeah, and we have in the past, you know, occasionally sold out, you know, with like the Pathfinder Core rulebook or the Adventure Card Game by like, you know, day three or four. We brought 50% more product than the best we'd ever done, and you blew through it yesterday afternoon. So that was amazing, and we apologize to everybody who didn't have a four-day badge.
In good faith, in our wildest hopes, we thought we had enough.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what the number is?
No, probably not.
I literally can't, right? I mean, the number was It was a big old pile.
But I'm not supposed to. But it was pallets of books, of even just like that one book. It was really an incredible, incredible amount. And judging by what's going on Amazon right now with them in terms of sales ranking, it's kind of going everywhere. So... They're still available in game stores. They're still available in bookstores on Amazon.
Currently still available on Paizo.com.
Yeah. You can get them literally anywhere except our booth downstairs because all of them are with those other people.
Can someone do me a favor and grab the door just so that we are not echoing into the... Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
You're both too friendly.
Yeah. Stop it.
But all right, so the real question is, what do you guys want to know? Why'd you show up? Okay, there we go. Are we ready to start? Let's start on that side.
Okay. So I know that there's like one healing class, the Mystic, but there's also like alternatives with the medicine. Well, what are the options for medicine skill? I've read something like the Envoy can recover some stamina points, but like what can you get by without a Mystic healing-wise, and what are the options in order to do that?
Yeah.
I run a playtest with four soldiers. And they did fine. So the important thing is that you have stamina and you have hit points. And your damage goes to stamina before it goes to hit points unless it's a special ability that says otherwise. So unless we call it out, it always goes to stamina first. You can, out of combat, take a 10-minute break, burn one resolve point, everyone gets resolve points, and get back all of your stamina. With a group of four soldiers, that frequently ended up meaning that because it was four soldiers, they would blow anything away before they had taken anything but stamina damage, take a rest, be fine, move on. The Envoy is the only class currently that can recover stamina in combat. I believe they're one of the archetypes might have some ability, but the only other base classes. The Mystic is the only class that has magic healing of other people as a major ability. They can pick it up as spells. They also have a backup power. But healing serums aren't expensive. So even at first level, a new first level character can afford to buy one or two healing serums, unlike in Pathfinder, where that would be a major investment. And they scale up some. So the expectation is that you're going to take a lot of stamina damage. You'll burn your resolves to recover your stamina damage. When you take hit point damage, it's either because you got right up in the middle of things and are tanking, or because the things are going south, or the GM got really lucky. And you want your Mystic around for that. That is a useful function for them. But we've had games with no magic healing whatsoever, and it is still a viable playstyle.
You've also got the medicine skill, which does, outside of combat, take a minute, and you can give some people some hit points back as well.
And there's the Envoy has an ability that allows them to be better with that as a surgical power. And there's, like, slap patches, which allow you to do things more quickly. So there are some options already that is modestly robust, and obviously that's an area where we'll be looking at playstyle and adding stuff as the game develops.
And philosophy-wise, as we mentioned in the last panel, I'll try not to go on too long, but one of the reasons why we did that, why we did the stamina hit points breaking is because we wanted to sort of reduce the 5-minute adventuring day, and also because there is an appeal to, you know, okay, we're going through, we're fighting, everything's fine, but then to start to get wounded. Like, one of the things that Pathfinder doesn't really do is reflect the difference between I have 100 hit points and I have 1 hit point. There's not really that same level of fear there in some ways, and I think that it can be nice when in Starfinder you've got a character who you can take a whole bunch of stamina damage, but as soon as they have that one fight where they start taking hit point damage, they can be afraid, but actually have, like, they can get all their stamina back, so they can keep going. It's not like as soon as you're scared, you're dead. I think it's really important that it's like, oh, I've only got a few hit points. I've got all the stamina, so I'm good, but I'm a little shaken.
It's a warning sign rather than the beginning of a mechanical death spiral.
Exactly. Sure.
Follow up to that. How do you recover resolve?
You get a good night's sleep.
Okay, so it just replenishes.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Right there.
Can you speak to the design philosophy about separating the starship cost from the currency in the game?
Yeah.
So there was some talk on. We did a Reddit AMA, and someone was asking about, well, why don't you give at least a credit cost for build points for people who want to do that? And I said, I can't really. We wanted to completely divorce that because starships are just downright expensive. So I said, take the price of a flashlight today, compare that to the cost to launch the shuttle, and then in Starfinder, a flashlight costs 1 credit. And then if you want to go ahead and do the math. And someone actually went ahead and did the math. So 1 build point equals something like 750,000 credits.
Yeah.
Not officially, just sort of like if you, you know, just sort of roughly.
This is not canon.
Not canon. Just sort of someone did that math, and that's what they came up with. So basically we wanted to keep that up apart so that you don't have to. If someone says, we need that 1 build point to maybe boost our engines, and the GM's like, here's 750,000 credits in this adventure, and then the next party says, I don't want to spend that, I'm going to buy all of the weapons. So it would just throw things wildly out of balance.
Yeah.
So starships are an option in Starfinder. They're a crucial option. We assume that a lot of groups they're going to have a starship, it'll go along with them. But you can play a Starfinder game that is set entirely on Absalom Station, never goes anywhere else. Aliens come to you, and you don't even own a starship. So if you can exchange credits for build points, then you are constantly at risk of 2 possible imbalances. 1, Han Solo decides to remove his concussion missile launcher from the Millennium Falcon so that he can wear powered battle armor and have star bazookas. That sort of thing never happens in fiction. But if we had this economy, it could. Or 2, Han Solo decides, I am never getting out of the Millennium Falcon. He doesn't even bother to have a blaster in his pistol in his pocket so that he can get 1 more concussion missile. Either way, that means that the expected range of options that a player has will be way off for your tier or your level. So if the GM decides that this game is going to have starships, then you can, as a plot, decide, look, you're into it for Jabba the Hutt, or you guys fought a space war on the losing side, and you're constantly on the run in the outskirts for the galaxy, or you're Earth's last best hope, and there's a giant ship that you all have fighters out of. Those are campaign plot concerns. We don't want the players to then take that plot concern and turn it into a whole bunch of healing serum.
Yeah. Yeah, there's also the third option that you didn't mention is some people would sell their starship and go, great, I retire.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds so boring, and yet I have absolutely played in those games where, you know, players, you know, they defeat the bad guys who have killed the innkeeper, and hooray, that's great, that's the start of the first encounter, and then they go, well, now we have a free inn. Like, I set up shop. I buy inventory. You know, and just refuse to adventure, right? Like that in a quest for realism, right? So, I felt like from the very beginning, and this was also, I mean, I think we were all on the same page.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, it's really important to us that you be able to have a starship from level one. And so anything that we make, if we made it an economic decision, there would always be reasons why it's better not to do that thing, which is a core trope of the game. And so that's one of the few places in the core rulebook where we just flat out say, like, we kind of break character narratively and just say, like, hey, GMs, like, players, yes, this is not realistic, right? Deal with it. You know, like, you will have so much more fun if you just get over the idea that you can sell your starship and buy, you know, a level 20 gun at first level.
And, you know, might just retire. As it is, if you take your 1,000 starting credits and you put it all into field rations, you can have 20 years of food. I presume no one will do that, but if you can have 20 years of food and a house, suddenly that starts to be a logical conclusion for some people. So,
like right now. Yeah.
Got a starship at level one. Doesn't everybody?
Well,
no.
That's the thing. Right? Yeah,
but the answer is no, because the campaign decides who has a starship and why do you have it.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go right there.
Hi. So, two things real quick. On the starship, if I'm right, the first level starship was a 55-point build. It was the number of characters at their level divided by, I'm sorry, the levels of the characters divided by the number of characters you had. So if you had a party of five at all first level, then you would have a tier one ship, and the tier one ship is always a 55-point build.
Yeah.
Okay, so if we had each individual person in the party wanted to build their own fighter, so that you had a party that hit the space waves in a group of fighter, each person would get a 55-point fighter?
No.
Okay.
It's just sort of meant to be for a group ship.
Okay.
Now, you might, we haven't given you sort of guidelines for that, but if you ever want to play the we're playing a bunch of X-Wing fighters campaign sort of thing, you're going to have to fudge up with the build points in some fashion, because each frame costs the amount of build points, and now if you have to buy five frames, it's going to really eat into it, and you're going to be way less power than you should be for that tier.
So that build is for a group of people, not really for a single character.
That's
yeah,
right.
It's for Serenity, not Rogue Squadron.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And this is in part an issue of core rulebook versus expansion rulebook. There are going to be campaigns that don't have starships at all, so we only have so much space to put to it.
But
obviously, we will want to expand on these rules, and when we do, we can look at, hey, if you want to play Rogue Squadron, or the other extreme, right? If you want to play Yamato, these are things we can possibly do, but that isn't a core concept. Those are sort of fringe campaigns.
Yeah.
The second thing, can you please pronounce the name of the machine god?
Triune? Yeah, Triune.
Yeah, because we had some discussions as we were looking at the PDF on exactly how to pronounce the name.
You can just call it the all code and move on.
Yeah, and Triune is just like the word, but there are, if your default for anything else, whether it's like Lashunta or stuff like that, when in doubt, if it was one of the things that I made up, it probably sounds like Spanish, because that's the only language I know anything about. And so there's a lot of stuff like, you know, like the elf gates, the Ayudara that have been in Pathfinder since the beginning. It's just because Ayudar is to help in Spanish, and those gates seem really helpful.
Yeah!
At least that's not... At least that's not the worst one. Is Jason Bulman? Anybody familiar with the Knights of Alzum?
Yes.
Yeah. So you know that's great. That's cool. That's a fine name. And it was only years later that Jason was like, "Hey, you know why they're called the Knights of Alzum?" I was like, "Why?" Because they're awesome. It's like, oh. Sorry, I wish I didn't know that.
Now we all share our burden.
The secrets of Starfinder pedals tomorrow. So remember that story.
That's true.
Yeah.
Let's jump over here a little bit. Right there next to Bowie.
The question's related to starships again, and it seems like that you could have a really crappy freighter and be able to maneuver it a lot easier as a pilot than, say, a fancy souped-up fighter jet type.
Because the DC scale with its tier of the starship.
Well, yes. I mean, the point is being like, at your level, you have your tier of that spaceship. You're often not going to necessarily have one that's wildly off. Like, it's just, we'll just keep a tier one spaceship, because then you're not going to be able to afford the shields and the weapons that you need to actually fight the things that you should be fighting at your level.
Your crappy freighter is easier at barrel rolls. They're just slow, ugly, crappy barrel rolls. This is the difference between driving a giant, slow dump truck where I can make a left-hand turn with no problems, and being in a race car. It is harder to make a race car turn at speed because it goes faster. It can do more. So, in fact, it's got more bells and whistles and levers and racing slicks, and that makes it harder. So a little of that is an abstraction, but it's also because our assumption is the more awesome your starship is, the more skill it takes to run it, because anyone can run a dump truck, space freighter. If anyone remembers the television show Quark, anyone? One person, thank you, sir. Going out and picking up the space trash is easier than going to meet new people and shoot them.
All right, let's do right here.
On the topic of starship scaling PCs.
Man, this is the Jason.
All right, fine, there may be.
No, hold it.
Really high.
Yes.
How are 20th level PCs supposed to make those DC 70 so checks?
That question came up yesterday. We're looking at it. We do not have an official answer at this time.
We did have some playtest issues, then we bumped them down, and then we had some math issues going in, and things got a little
muddied. So we're looking at it, but we don't have an answer for you yet.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's go right there.
So a question about alien races.
Yeah.
Love the game, everything I've read so far.
Thank you.
So there's an alien race that's kind of like mice, and there's an alien race that's kind of like lizards, and there's an alien race that's kind of like centipedes.
Yeah.
So we wanted more alien-type alien races. Is there going to be...
Alien Archive. In 2 months.
2 months.
One of the big things we wanted to do is, for this book... We understood that, like, we have really limited space. We want to make sure we hit the most sort of universally accepted
iconic
kind of things, iconic things, because we know that in general people tend to gravitate towards very humanoid aliens. But we know a lot of people want the weird stuff. So we put the weird stuff in Alien Archive, and one of our design philosophies since the beginning has been that we want to, when in doubt, let you play a thing, whereas in Pathfinder we're very restricted on what can be, you know, a player race. You know, it's very important that they be very, you know, basic humanoid, you know, all these different things.
You're not going to be able to play a mimic in a Pathfinder game, for instance.
But in Starfinder, we specifically want to, we loosened the guidelines so that, you know, there's a little more crazy wiggle room that a GM's going to have to take into account. But as a result, you get to play your crazy seven-armed starfish. You get to play your floating jellyfish creature. You know, the one I'm excited about, the contemplatives, you're basically a giant floating psychic brain with a little atrophied body dangling underneath it.
And one hand.
And one good hand that we didn't notice until like a few months ago. We were like, they have a hand. I didn't notice. Yeah. And they've been around for years. But so a lot of that weird stuff you're going to see in Alien Archive, and you're going to see in all of our monster stuff, because when in doubt, we want you to be able to play it. That's how you get that Mos Eisley Cantina feel, and that's why we made this game.
and we've got a Pact Worlds book that's going to be coming, which we thought we'd announce and we hadn't. But and so we're also going to be expanding some of the things, even in the Pact Worlds, that seven-armed shape-shifting starfish.
Yeah, that one's actually from Pact Worlds.
That is not a random example. That is a thing that we have art for. Yeah. So I keep saying eventually I will in fact stat up a hyper-intelligent shade of blue. We'll get there. We had to start with core.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And move into the weirder and weirder realms. Yeah. And we will get there.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks, Melissa.
Right there.
Part of previous editions of games, assume that you're going to have like 3 to 5 encounters a day, and then you're probably need to take a rest. Is that still baked into Starfinder, or is there a different
idea? You want to recap?
On average, we expect people to be able to go through 4 to 8 encounters, but we kind of don't care, and here's why. What we care about is that all the characters should be able to go through roughly the same number of encounters, so they all decide to stop at the same time. So, in Pathfinder, one of the problems you have is that the cleric or wizard can say, I'm out of spells, and the fighter can say, but I still have stab. I bought a lot of stab, and I'm not out of stab. I'd like to go stab something. And the wizard says, I'm sorry, I can't fire something, so you're not allowed to stab it. That causes a problem. With resolve points, which everyone has, and you get your stamina back with resolve points, and everyone has jetpacks and battery-driven blasters and grenades and other options, it both means that one of the important resources, resolve points, you're all running through at close to the same rate. You'll have slightly different values. You might take more or less damage, but you all have a thing that's counting down. And when you're a third-level sorcerer is out of spells, or fifth or ninth, the higher level it gets, the worse it is. And you say, yeah, but you've still got a crossbow. They're like, what's a crossbow? I can't do anything with a crossbow. When your technomancer's out of spells, you go, you've got a flamethrower, a grenade, and a jetpack. And they're likely to go, yeah, I do. Okay. That's fair. I can still fire. You can still stab. So there's a lot that's going to depend on how the GM throws things together, right? If the GM goes, I want all encounters to be average party level +2 and it's always epic, you won't get through as many. But after 2 or 3, you'll probably all be going, we need to get back to the starship and recharge our plasma cannons. Great, you all need to go do that. If everything is APL -2, you might do 12 and be fine. But the important thing is that since you have similar resource management issues and other options, even when you run out of specifically something like spells, you end up being able to move together more easily.
More questions. Let's go right there.
These rules, new rules for Starfinder, will any of them be able to be imported back into like Pathfinder, or will that be just left up to the GM?
So we sort of already did that. It was called Pathfinder Unchained. A lot of stuff from Unchained, which was experimental for Pathfinder, we thought worked better for Starfinder. So the monster building rules are based off Unchained. Afflictions are based off Unchained. Some of the math on where things come from came from things that grew out of Unchained. Pathfinder's Pathfinder, and we're pretty happy with the Pathfinder experience. The Pathfinder design team is always looking at everything, and they wrote chunks of this book, obviously. So I can't say it'll never happen, but my expectation is that Pathfinder will keep being Pathfinder, and we will explore new stuff with Starfinder.
Yeah.
The specific things were like the stamina points and the resolve points.
You can do whatever you want, but we are not, like, the point of Starfinder is not to then be like, great, now let's overhaul Pathfinder to match Starfinder. Like, they're two different game systems doing different things.
Yeah.
So Pathfinder remains Pathfinder.
That say, I will leap in and say that Paizo went to a great deal of effort to allow a lot of third-party publishers early access to the rules, and there's already third-party material available. It will shock me not at all if someone comes along and says, you know, here's resolve and stamina rules for Pathfinder.
Yeah.
I'm thrilled that that market exists for all sorts of reasons, but one of them is that I think things like that that some people want, that everyone doesn't want, that's the perfect environment for it.
Yeah. Let's go right. Anybody we haven't gotten yet? Let's go right there.
I looked at the races and I noticed that some of the other races, the only one you guys have kept from Pathfinder was the human. And then I went through searching the book.
Yeah, yeah.
I get tired of reading, so I read ahead. And
sure,
go
yeah,
back
yeah, yeah.
I was reading. And I went all the way back of the book and I saw the dwarf, the half elf, and I saw those. Are those also playable characters?
Yes.
I read all
yeah, yeah, no, yeah, absolutely. 100%. That's so there's actually, in some ways, a lot more races in this book than in the Pathfinder core rulebook. So we really wanted, you know, when we were originally conceiving of what are the races going to be in this book, we wanted to make sure that this wasn't just Pathfinder in space. Like, you know, we sort of jokingly call it that, but we wanted it to be its own thing. And one of the things that is really fun with a science fantasy game is playing aliens, playing robots, playing all of these different things. And so we wanted to create a new core race set that really focused on that sort of stuff, the sort of stuff that we were most excited about for a science fantasy game. And that also would, frankly, give us some new ground, give players something new. So that it's not just here are dwarves in space, here are elves in space.
But
because we kind of already know those, but we also knew that those are really important, and that if Owen didn't get a space dwarf, he was going to flip a table and leave. And so
he's only sort of kidding. We had a long conversation about whether what we ended up calling the legacy races were going in the book.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of significant disagreement. And in the end, at one point, Eric Mona said, "Wait, are we arguing over 6 pages?"
Yeah.
Put them in.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. And I think that, and I think we were all really pleased that we did, because we do want to play with those races. It is still the Pathfinder setting. We want those races to be prominent. We just don't want them to be the sole focus of things, because while they've changed some, they've only really changed a little bit. And so I sort of, in a weird way, by having the focus be on these new races, where we can do sort of all of our playing and have new crazy ideas, it allowed us to keep elves and dwarves and thing and gnomes a little more the way they are in Pathfinder, because we didn't feel like we weren't getting to play, you know? Because as designers, we want to do new stuff. You know, we were really excited to introduce new races like the Sheeran and the Vesk, because that's where we get a lot of our joy, is creating new stuff that people haven't seen before, rather than just updating stuff that we did 10 years ago, right?
From a rules point of view, all the rules you need are in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, yes, they're not core, but we do not have racial favored class bonuses. We do not have race-only feats. We do not have race-only archetypes. Some of that might enter the game in a minor way, but even there are people that feel like there's a feat in here that requires you to have 4 arms, and everyone says, oh, well, that's a Kasatha feat. Sure, a Kasatha, or anyone that buys 2 cyber arms, because the requirement is not Kasatha. The requirement is you got to have 4 arms. If we do another 4-armed race, or if you buy 2 arms, or if some poor contemplative buys 3, then you can access that feat. Because of that, one of the things that happens in Pathfinder is that if it's not a core race, game mechanically you are at a disadvantage, because we have not given you as many options. Dwarves have more options than Lashunta in Pathfinder, because Lashunta are a major race on another planet. In Starfinder, Lashunta are one of the major races of the solar system we're focusing on, and dwarves are a minority race that apparently dug themselves out of a hole on a planet that doesn't exist anymore. They're around, they're just not as important. But that won't matter, because you're not going to be at some disad because we don't have 9 dwarf archetypes. We're not going to have race-specific things like that. And especially in the future, if we do a Lashunta archetype, it will actually probably be, here is an archetype from people that were trained in this culture. And if your dwarf went and trained in that culture, you can have that archetype. You may have to glue antenna on, but
yeah, or people who are telepathic.
Right, exactly.
Whatever, and then that's also useful for Sheeran and whatnot.
So that means that even though they are non-core, and the same thing's going to be true of the Alien Archive, if you want to play a contemplative of Vashok, you won't be at a mechanical disadvantage compared to someone playing a human.
Yeah. All right. Right there.
You touched on this before about monster creation rules. When Bestiary 1 came out, with the amount of rules you guys had about the monster types and aggression, you basically have all of the math on this is how you build a monster. Do you intend to have that same level of detail in Alien Archive or whatever is
yes.
the Bestiary for this
game? 100%. There's a big appendix in the back that says how to make new aliens in Starfinder, and it has all the steps. And it's very similar to what you have in Pathfinder Unchained. Pick an array and pick some stuff, and we threw in all the subtypes that we could fit in there. We threw in some extra ones that weren't maybe not even in the book. We just try to get a nice rounded area, and then as many of the universal creature rules as we could fit.
And you can make a brand new CR-16 monster that is appropriate and interesting in 5 minutes.
Yeah. It's super easy.
Just to emphasize, you will have all of the information that we give to our designers and developers when they're creating stuff. So you'll have the same toolkit that somebody making monsters for an AP will have. It's all right there.
It's a big galaxy. We can't possibly fill it all ourselves, so we want to give you the tools to do that.
Yeah. Let's go right there.
There's no really difference between medium and small as far as size goes. The way that there is in Pathfinder, what's the reasoning behind that?
You guys
want
to speak to...
Playing a size small paladin with a greatsword sucks. Turns out gnomes and dwarves are good at making stuff, so over 2,000 years, they fixed it.
Owen, champion of the small people.
There is a level of granularity that detracts from fast gameplay. We are of necessity, adding lasers and faster-than-light travel, we don't want to ask someone to just constantly put more and more and more and more in their brain space. And the distinction between, hey, I'm size small, and therefore I have a smaller area, and therefore I'm harder to hit, but I also have a higher dex, so I'm already harder to hit. And I'm size small, and I'm only harder to hit because I've got a better dex, and maybe I pick better armor choices, and I can hide behind smaller pieces of terrain, was not, in our opinion, worth carrying over, because that would boost complexity. And honestly, we were hoping that Starfinder would be total, as a whole, less complex than Pathfinder. So, yes, it is true that there is the only game mechanical distinction between being small and being medium, basically, is how tall are you, how much you do weigh, and how small a hole can you cram yourself into. But those are the two sizes that almost all players are. And so having them be the same was easier for the player. So you don't have to say, if I want to be a melee combatant and I choose gnome, I am putting myself at a disadvantage for an interesting idea. Yeah. We don't want to do that.
Yeah, in general, that was one of the things where we were trying, like, not putting myself at a disadvantage for an interesting idea was really a guiding design principle for a lot of the stuff of how we developed the races, how we developed the classes, how we developed the themes, really trying to make sure that it wasn't a game where there's one optimal build for every class, and if you don't play that one, you're dumb. You know, like, because I really like, I mean, we all really like diversity of characters in a party. Like, and it's really, it's annoying when everybody at your table figures out the best way to do a thing, and then stops telling interesting stories, right? So we really tried to make sure that the rules promoted creativity in character design.
For the most part, most small races have also started to train their children to sprint at birth because they've got 30-foot move rates. The only exception to the 30-foot move rate of the player characters in the core book is the dwarf, and that was actually a discussion where I managed to win that dwarves should be slow because they're not core. So you're picking a non-core race. Yeah. We're okay with that 20-foot move rate. But again, it's a matter of this is a level of granularity that did not, for this game, with everything we had, the option we put together, did not seem like it would increase fun.
All right, let's go back in the hat. Yeah.
Okay, spell gems, real quick. You can buy a spell gem first level for 50 credits, I believe. Once you use it once, it says that it becomes unfunctional. A caster can then turn around and make a spell gem. When they are traveling, not near a place, can I use that one gem, the spells consumed in it? In the book it says it kind of becomes dead.
Yep.
Do I have to take that and throw that out? Or when I go to make my new soul gem, or I'm sorry, not soul gem,
spell gem.
Yeah. Can I just pull that dead one out and use that to make the new gem? Thus far, I don't have to run back to the settlement city or whatever to make a new gem.
You can totally do that. The process of doing that costs exactly the same and takes exactly the same number of UPB as making it from scratch.
Perfect. That's
You don't need a gem to make a spell gem. What you need is 50 UPBs to then form a crystalline matrix when you put the magic in it and create a gem. So as long as you've got UPBs, you can make anything. If I've got a bucket of UPBs and I've got the skill ranks and the time, I can pour them into a gem, I can pour them into a blaster, I can pour them into a suit of armor, I can create a hamburger machine if we have one, put it, stat it up in the rules.
UPB, we do not. Which of course stands for Universal Polymer Base, which was, we decided we needed these units of something, and we were trying to figure out how to even discuss that in the office, and that was like the first placeholder we threw out. It was like, what about Universal Polymer Base? UPB. Whatever, ship it.
It's good.
Great.
Okay. Yeah. It's good.
And as a result, Starfinder now has a UPB-based economy. The number of UPBs it takes to make a one-credit object cost one credit.
Yeah.
Now, that means that you personally can't make a profit on making things. Only Abadar Corp, that has economy of scale and vast factory planets that cranks out 10 billion of a thing and therefore can do it for less, they can make money. But it does mean that you personally, if you are cut off from supply and I've got a bucket of UPBs, you can make anything you need.
And they always come in buckets.
They are very similar to fried chicken in that regard.
All right, let's go right back there.
What's your favorite mechanic or rule that made it into the final product?
Ooh.
That's
let's all think for a second.
Favorite rule.
Okay, I'll go. They're not. I got one.
You got one.
Three. And only three things provoke an attack of opportunity. Three. If you leave a threatened square, if you make a ranged attack, or if you cast a spell that doesn't say otherwise, that's it. And as long as I am the design lead, that will remain it. Nothing else provokes. Standing from prone does not provoke. Pulling something out of my bag does not provoke. Making a skill check does not provoke. Climbing does not provoke. Because the game bogs down when you are doing those weirder things. And those weirder things are way more common in Starfinder. We didn't want to get rid of it because if someone sets up a pike line, I don't want someone to go dancing through the pike line and have no consequence. But I do want to simplify it so that you don't constantly go, okay, I tie my shoes. Wait, does that provoke? Is that going to kill me? No. Three. Three things, and I'm really happy about it.
So, Owen, let's see if you remember. Was there any of the things where I drew a line in the sand and said, I have this design consideration where I hate this and I don't want to do it that way? Were there any of those fights that I won?
I mean, there were a lot where we changed how I wanted to do it so as to make you happy.
What made me happy?
Okay, so we were talking about settlement stat blocks.
That's right. That was what I was thinking of.
And Sutter put out an email that said, there will be no settlement stat blocks. I hate them. I don't want them. They limit the game. They're terrible.
I have been fighting with Pathfinder Creative Director James Jacobs about those literally since they were introduced in the Game Mastery Guide. I was like, come on.
And I wrote back to him and I said, okay, so where are we going to tell them what the population is? It's fine. We can tell them the population. Okay, where are we going to tell them what kind of government it is? Fine. We can tell them what the government is. Okay, where are we going to tell them what the average level of stuff you can buy is so the GM knows? Fine, we can tell them that. Can I put it all together and make it a stat block? So, what we don't... it is true that he once tweeted, why do I even draw these lines in the sand? But it keeps going over them.
Yeah.
In Pathfinder, if we have a feature, say, major financial center, then that is a little tiny +2 bonus on what the chaos level, the law level, and the safety level and all that is, which means that making a stat block is both an annoying process and you could end up having the numbers on the city wrong. In Starfinder, stat blocks are purely descriptive, and we will add a few descriptors if we think those words are useful for the players and the GM. And if we need to, we'll just make up new ones, and they don't have to mean anything, and they don't have any modifiers. If we say, vile den of scum and villainy, then everyone has a pretty good idea what that means, or majorly religious, or you know, trade city, whatever it is. We can describe it in a few words without having to get into what does this have as an impact on the law modifier that changes all of your skill checks. That again is that level of granularity.
And
so
really the biggest thing was, just as a game master, it drove me nuts that why does population have to control the economy,
right?
And what's available, right? If I have a city of wizards, and there's 30 of them, but they're all level 20, you can get whatever magic item you want in
exactly.
that city, and I just want rules that allow that.
Whereas
right?
if this is the field of potato farmers, and there are a million of them, it turns out they don't have a staff of the magi in the background just because there are a million of them. So, and this is actually, I think, very indicative of a lot of the design process, right? There were a lot of places where one of us would say, I hate this thing, and we should get rid of it. And instead of just saying yes or no, we'd go, what do you hate about this thing? How can we remove the hate from the thing? Are there good things about the thing that we want to keep?
Well, and also it reflects the balance that really changes from all of us on the team. The question of how much we wanted to leave up to GMs and how much we wanted to be, you know, sort of prescriptivist about stuff. And everybody really changes, right? Like, obviously, you know, there's stuff where it's like, you know, we've got John Compton and Ordplay on one end being like, please don't just say it's all up to the GM. Do you know how hard that will make our lives as Ordplay? And then you've got me as somebody who's, you know, my home group being like, whatever, I don't like that rule, leave it aside. You know, like, where do you strike that balance? And I think we pretty much made everybody happy in the end. Or at least ish. We made everybody an equal level of sad. That's the same as happy, right?
This game has to both serve organized play and home play, and for that matter, there are going to be people
different player types.
Yeah, there are going to be people that buy it just because they want to read the book and they don't even plan to run it, and we're aware of all of that. So there will be a few things. I think the theme outlaw power that lets you get out of having done something illegal by paying some random amount of money, I suspect there will be a different power for that in organized play eventually. Just because they're trying to have a consistent experience with thousands of people. Fine, that is a corner case where we have gone way too narrativist for them. But I do think we've done a pretty good job overall of trying to strike a middle balance. That is one of the reasons why all items have levels. If you're a first level character and you get a hold of a 20th level gun, no magic power prevents you from pulling the trigger. You can use it. That's exactly the same as your first level paladin getting a plus 5 Vorpal Holy Avenger that's a bane against NPCs, right? You hand that out to a player at first level, there's no rule that says they can't use it. They're just going to ruin the campaign is all. Same deal. But with item levels, there were good things about item levels, so we can say things like, hey, it turns out gun control may not be universal, but even a black market arms dealer may not want to sell you a nuclear weapon for fear that you will use it in a way that will get him in trouble. So in general, we assume that you have the licensing and the contacts and the reputation to pick up any piece of equipment within one or two levels of your level. That lets us not have to worry about track what your current reputation is with the arms dealers, the drow arms dealers out on Apostate. We don't have to worry about that. Are you ninth level? Then people trust you with 11th level and less equipment. The GM can wibble and wobble with that, but we now have a baseline rule. It also means that when we're working out the prices or what the save DC is or the hardness or the hit points, those can all be based on a mechanic. So we don't have to list, this is the hardness for a short sword. This is the hardness for a long sword. This is the hardness for a plus one magic longsword. The level tells you, and then we've got abilities that can alter that if it's particularly sturdy.
Let me say my thing.
Right.
Let me talk. I'm here too. So the thing that I really like that we added, and it's not exactly a rules thing, but we, at the end of every class, we do these four sort of sample builds, sort of giving you, oh, if you want to play your operative as more of a hacker, or an operative that's more of a investigator, bounty hunter type deal, and giving you sort of basic, if you've put in deck, put your best thing in decks. Maybe take this special series. Maybe take these feats and put ranks in these skills. These aren't playable anything. They're just sort of guidelines. But I think
they're blueprints.
They're blueprints, exactly. And then it really helps someone who might not know what they want to play yet and just get some ideas, or someone who's new to role playing. And I really, really think they're neat.
They also cram a lot of world building into a little area, right? Just the very fact that we have, as an operative, a trailblazer tells you something about one of the things we expect you to be able to do with that class.
All right, let's go right over there. Blue shirt.
Something about sci-fi systems is always broken down for me. If they are for a property, like West End Star Wars or Shadowrun or something, those work great. But if the system tries to cover TARDISes and lightsabers and time travel and Terminators, then it doesn't work for me. Is Starfinder, here's the setting, here's what we expect you to play, or is it more aiming for whatever you want to do, here are the mechanics to do that?
I mean, I think it's honestly much more like Pathfinder in a lot of ways, in that a lot of people said we were crazy for doing Pathfinder the way we were, because we tried to make it cater to everyone. Because you look at the Pathfinder setting, and you've got, Ustalov, which is our horror setting. You've got Vikings. That's cool. You want Middle Eastern fantasy? Great, we got that. Do you want traditional, knights and dragons and whatnot? We've got that. By trying to get sort of every setting and genre we loved into the same world, people thought that would really kind of ruin it. And in fact, as it turned out, people really got into it because people found the parts that they liked, played in those, and then didn't worry about the rest. With Starfinder, we're kind of trying to do the same thing where, this rule set, you can play, if you want to play more of a Star Wars-style game, you can. If you want to play more of a Shadowrun-style cyberpunk game, you can. If you want to play space horror, if you want to do Event Horizon or Alien, you can absolutely do that with these rules. So we're trying to cater to all those different ones. And then within the context of the setting, we're giving you a setting that's very, hopefully, very tight and interesting. And, here's this solar system that's well-detailed. It's got enough fun stuff that you could play there forever. You could play an entire campaign on one world if you want to. But there's also literally a billion other planets in the galaxy that you can now reach. So you as a game master can go do whatever you want, any setting out there, or whether it's a property that you want to kind of modify or something entirely of your own making. Hopefully a lot of that you can just sort of skin right into Starfinder and play with that. So we're really trying to walk the line.
But there are no TARDISes, and that kind of speaks to your point.
It's not trying to do every sci-fi genre.
In just most of them.
I have a personal pet theory on why fantasy role-playing games are, in general, more popular than science fiction role-playing games. And that general theory is that if a group of players are told they're doing a fantasy role-playing game, and one of them wants to be King Arthur, and one of them wants to be Randolph Thor, and one of them wants to be Conan the Barbarian, and one of them wants to be Merlin, they can all envision all four of those characters existing in the same world. Different cultures, different bases, but I can see all those characters pulling together. And so we can do a whole bunch of different things, much like Pathfinder does. In science fiction, if one person wants to be Locke the Superman, and one person wants to be a lensman, and one person wants to be Captain Kirk on the Starship Enterprise, and one of them wants to be RoboCop, those are all valid science fiction character concepts, but it is really hard to see them all working together in a similar plot line, right? Are they on the Enterprise? Are they not on the Enterprise? Does OCP own Captain Kirk and RoboCop? And so those concepts just don't necessarily gel as well together. So one of the reasons that Starfinder has a baked-in setting is so that we can say, here is our setting. It is vast and diverse and has a whole bunch of stuff, but a whole bunch of stuff includes gods, magics, demons, spells. So that is part of the baked-in setting. So we want you to be able to do a lot of different flavors, but we are not, in fact, trying to present a rule book that says, there's no science fiction game you can't play in this. And this is the core set. There are no mecha in here. We are all very sad there are no mecha in here. Of course, all right-thinking people believe there should be mecha in Starfinder eventually, but that's just not core. So we will probably end up at some point saying here are our mecha rules, and here is the place in the Starfinder universe where they are common enough to be relevant. That just doesn't happen to be the pack worlds.
All right, time for just a couple more, sort of speed round.
Is there anyone we haven't had a question from yet that has a question?
All right, well then, right there, yeah.
Can you go into why you decided not to have ninth level spellcasting?
Sure.
Yeah.
A ninth level spellcaster is defined by his spell list. Wizards, clerics, psionics, they have a very thin set of things other than their spells that they can do. We are exploring a brand new world. We wanted lots of cool stuff for those classes. Also, as I mentioned, we were trying to dial the complexity down a little bit. So we don't have prepared spellcasters, and we don't have hybrid spellcasters like the Arcanist, because asking a new player to learn three different ways that you cast spells is harder than saying, you pick these spells, you know them, you can cast them as long as you have three slots. So only spontaneous. And once we have made that decision, only sixth level, because your sixth level spellcasters, your bards, and your inquisitors, and your war priests, and your magi, they can all have more interesting class features above and beyond I know spells. So by doing that, we were able to say, we have six levels of spells, it'll be easier for our two classes to share some spells, because this is a huge book. We don't have room for as many spells as Pathfinder has. Also, we don't have room for as many spells as Pathfinder has. So when we went through all our design guidelines, it made the most sense, since spells are only part of a science fantasy setting, to go for a middle ground, six-level spellcasters, prepared spellcasters, and that did everything we wanted to do. Now, we did kludge a little, because we said at 20th level, a technomancer can ram two six-level spells together and cast Wish. Because Wish is awesome. From a world design point of view, you always want to be able to say, you walk up in the ancient tower where a vast crystal hovers there because someone wished it once. We want that option. Mystics have a similar option that I think once a week. You can call upon a miracle. I am so connected to the universe that I can make something happen that just shouldn't happen. So they're six-level spellcasters with a particularly tasty capstone because we wanted to leave those in the game as options. That doesn't mean we'll never do nine-level casters. Obviously, this is a place where we're going to be listening to people and getting feedback, and where third-party publishers will probably leap in there maybe tomorrow. but for this book, that made the most sense. And just as, you know, we didn't have psychic magic in core Pathfinder, heck, we didn't have archetypes in core Pathfinder, and those have absolutely become a core part of the game. In this game, we have some basic archetypes in there. We don't have 7th, 8th, 9th level spells. We don't have prepared spellcasters. We might bring those in someday if we saw a need. And that's just something we'll look at as we go along.
But I actually do think that that's, thinking of what my favorite rules change is, I actually think the simplification of magic is one of them, because I do think it makes it so much easier for people to learn. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to remove the arcane divine distinction, just because it's all this added complexity that doesn't really change what you're doing and how you're playing, like from a conceptual standpoint.
Yeah, in hard rules, there are like three things in all of Pathfinder that it matters whether it's arcane or divine. There's arcane spell failure, but that's not a hard rule because magi and bards can ignore it, and we were going to put everyone in light armor regardless because that's also your spacesuit, and even if you're a wizard, you don't want to pop in space. So, so like, there are a couple people that are like, maybe Duergar, a +2 bonus to divine magic. Okay, yes, that is a level of granularity we skipped. It comes up so rarely. But it also means that you can say, I am playing a priest of the god of magic. Why is my magic divine instead of arcane? We don't care. If you are playing a mystic and you are connected to a god of magic, then your magic can be the same magic as everyone else's. Or you can make your technomancer a priest.
Yeah. All right, I think that is all the time we've got. So thank you guys very much, and we'll see you in the booth. Yeah.